Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Mr. Khosa at 7 o'clock. But right now, on this day, the 5th of October, in 1908, the individuals that were responsible for the Cullinan diamond finally came to a decision on how to cut the diamond up. Yes, the Cullinan diamond was cut up on this particular day, and it's significant because it took 3 months to decide on the cutting up of the diamond. Interestingly enough, the end result of that was that there were 9 major stones cut from the Cullinan diamond alongside 96 brilliant cut diamonds and a 9.5 carats of unpolished pieces. This is just the one side of the diamond that was cut. The other side was, of course, the 530 carat Star of Africa that was then placed into the British royal scepter. It's said that a lot of the other diamonds and other pieces of the Cullinan diamond still sit within the British royal family, and that's probably a conversation that might come up at some point in our future. I wonder who'll start it. Nonetheless, 1940 on this day, Franklin D. Roosevelt secured his third term as President of the United States. Interestingly enough, the United States would then decide just 11 years later, in February of 1951, that presidents can no longer serve more than 2 terms. I wonder if he was the cause of that. In 1941 on this day, the Japanese naval staff vacated their positions at Pearl Harbor. Actually, that works out to a 30-day notice period. Interesting times indeed. 1987 on this day, Governor Mbeki was released from Robben Island. You're tuned into the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we are taking a look at Fitch having considered the position of South Africa. They might be considering revising the credit outlook of South Africa and potentially re-rating us. We might finally get off junk status. We're going to speak to senior economist at PwC around that. Then we've got a conversation around the mergers and acquisitions landscape within South Africa and around the world. We're seeing a lot of deals going off. People with money are buying stuff. People without money are selling stuff. So we're going to look at that and see if we can understand the landscape a little bit better and see what kinds of deals make the most sense at this time from an investment point of view. Then we've also got a conversation around the investment case that exists for Gauteng. Believe it or not, at some point we were a country that was considered very easy to do business with. Today, we're not so easy to do business with, and hopefully we can get back to that point. We're going to speak to the team at Hudson Sandler around that and get a sense of how we get back to that point. And then, because it's Tuesday, we've got a Agri Tuesday feature this week, not a Property Tuesday feature. We're going to be taking a look at the local fruit industry.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As usual, we kick off the show with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. It's been a very interesting day of movements, mostly to the positive side. I'm joined on the line by Head of Research at F&B Wealth and Investments, Chantal Marks, to take a look at the market movements throughout the day and see if we can make sense of them. Good evening, Chantal. Lovely to speak to you again. Before we get started on the markets, do you think having the Cullinan diamond back in the possession of South Africa would have any benefits for South Africa?
I don't know. I think it might have a mental benefit for South Africans. But apart from that, I mean, perhaps you can put it in a museum. I'm not sure if anyone will come and look at it. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think if we have to look at the sale of diamonds, I'd like for South Africa to have the diamond back with the option to sell it so that we can at least make some money off of it. We didn't make money off of it the first time. Maybe we can make money off of it the second time. If there is still a demand for natural diamonds, I suppose, we are now moving into a lab-grown diamond kind of world. So very interesting. Perhaps we should speak to our friends at De Beers about this one of these days. Chantal, let's look at the movements throughout the day. It's been a very interesting day because we are in the midst, quite literally in the middle of the United States elections, and you'd think that markets would be a bit uncertain, a bit volatile about what's happening, but it kind of looks like markets are saying, while we don't know the result, we're going to have a good day, and then as the result comes back, we'll self-correct afterwards.
So if you look at the graph of the JSE today, it was actually quite quite volatile. It was up and down. And at one point around 4 p.m., the market was actually flat for the day. And then it pushed higher when the U.S. market opened quite enthusiastically. And the thing we need to understand about volatility is that it moves both ways, right? You can be in a holding pattern or a wait and see pattern, and that can result in a negative market movement, or it can result in a positive market movement. And volatility implies lots of movement. So I think we're still in a holding pattern, a volatile holding pattern. Today, it just ended up being a positive, volatile day.
Chantal, how do we prepare for the outcome of the elections? I mean, the volatility aspect of it is definitely something that's going to cause bigger swings than what we might expect. And from a South African perspective, we kind of have an idea of which is our preferred candidate who might be a little less anti-Africa or a little less pro-America first. And that's very clear from the Republican and the Democrat standpoint, how they navigate those international conversations. Are we expecting that the volatility for the rest of the week or even for the rest of the next couple of hours is something to be materially worried about if you're a South African investor in South African markets?
So I don't think so necessarily. What tends to happen with elections is that you might get some volatility going into elections and then a big reaction post the result based on what the market thinks the candidate is going to do, what the positioning is going to be. But ultimately, and particularly in US elections, because of the structure of their politics, it's actually very difficult to really push through meaningful, game-changing rule changes or legislation. It takes a really long time as well for things to actually start happening to that effect. So my thinking is whatever the outcome, we'll get that initial market reaction, and then things should start moving in the way that the macroeconomic environment is dictating and that the broader geopolitical environment is dictating and that economic growth globally is dictating. So it should be, there will be a short-term reaction. And the way that you prepare yourself for that is to make sure that when you are going into these periods of uncertainty, you have some powder dry, because inevitably when you have these big moves, there will be short-term mispricings and you could actually take advantage of opportunities that may have not been there prior to the event actually taking place.
Chantal, when we look at some of the local counters, I mean, resources are fighting back today as well, 1.3% or so in the green. At some point, this wasn't the case recently as well. I mean, as recently as Friday, I think back, we had a rather bearish day on the resources sector. How are we kind of faring? I mean, platinum pricing has been struggling along, trying to get above that $1,000 an ounce level, keep its head above that level. Palladium pricing as well. We got up to 1250. We're down back at 1,080 or so. How do we make sense of the resources sector, or at least the commodities spaces, reacting to the other volatility that exists in the market?
So with the resources sector, you have the specific drivers of demand for each of these industrial metals. And the depending on what the company is actually exposed to, that is how the share price will react. What I really like when things are quite uncertain, especially when the growth outlook is a little bit more uncertain, is to look at the diversified miners, because then you kind of hedge yourself, because not all of these commodity prices necessarily move in exactly the same way. With the platinum sector or the PGMs, I think it's quite interesting the types of moves that we're seeing. So we have seen a little bit of a base forming on the price for PGMs, and similarly for the PGM stocks as well. And I think investors are willing it higher, and that's why you see a lot of enthusiasm when we do see a bit of an increase in underlying PGM prices in those stocks. But I think that we still need that demand catalyst, kind of certainty that we are seeing a turn in the automotive sector, the demand is going to improve for vehicles, for internal combustion vehicles, for hybrid vehicles, because that's where PGMs are very important. And then for gold, it's also the gold price will be supported, I think, at least for the next year because of geopolitics. We are still seeing loads of central bank buying. We're now starting to see investors getting involved in the exchange-traded funds. So the miners on that side, I think, should continue to do quite well.
Chantal, speaking of those diversified miners that you like so much, Sibanye gave us an update on their performance. I think it was a production update for Q3. Did we see anything surprising there? I mean, the share price has been under pressure for quite some time, and they obviously benefit greatly from an increased kind of share price or increased platinum price. Did we get any surprises from that update?
So, firstly, they're the least diversified miner because they basically only have exposure to PGMs and gold. But I think that in that update, they showed that the PGM business is actually faring slightly better than what the market was expecting, particularly from a profitability perspective. And the expectation is that if it's more profitable than expected, cash flows could be better than expected, and the balance sheet won't be as stretched as we know that balance sheet is. I'm a little bit more circumspect. I think that balance sheet could still be under a lot of pressure. And what was a little bit disappointing to me from Sibanye's update was the gold portion of their portfolio. It is quite small. The mines are quite marginal. But when gold prices are high, these mines should be pumping. And it does seem as if profitability missed the mark there because of higher operating costs. So that's kind of a bit of a concern for me. But I think the share has been very cheap. It's been very much sold off. And perhaps the share price movement today, up over 10%, reflecting relief that it's not as bad as expected on the PGM front.
One of these days, Chantal, you and I are going to discuss the discount or the disassociation between the way the companies perform and the way the commodities perform. But that's a story for another conversation because it certainly needs more time. I want to look at the Rand quickly while we do still have time. It's holding steady against the US dollar at the moment, sitting below 17 Rand 50. We know that in times of uncertainty and all of that, this last couple of years as well, at least, the dollar has been a kind of a safe haven currency. And going into the US election, we did see the dollar index come off quite a bit, but it can just as quickly come back if the outcome of the election is a desired outcome or a favorable outcome, depending on which side of the market you sit on. Are we expecting the Rand to continue to strengthen at the moment, or will the outcome of the election potentially send us back towards 18 Rand?
So fundamentally speaking, the Rand should be strengthening. But as you rightly mentioned, during times of stress and volatility, there does tend to be a flight to safety to the US, even if the US is the source of the volatility and uncertainty. It's just the way that that our markets work. And if there is a confusion outcome in the US, so very similar to what we had last election cycle, where you kind of there had to be election reruns with senators, and the one candidate is saying that they actually won the whole thing, and that kind of scenario, you will see the dollar strengthening quite a bit, and we could see some near-term Rand weakness, and significantly so. I think in the event of a Trump presidency, the expectation is also that the dollar could temporarily strengthen. But I think in both of those scenarios, you will eventually see things return back to the fundamentals, very similar to what I said around the markets as well. You'll have the short-term impact and then a return to the fundamentals. And fundamentally speaking, I think the Rand should be a little bit stronger.
The Rand should be stronger. Whether or not it continues to get stronger remains to be seen. We'll see how that shapes up and how that unfolds. But for now, we've run out of time. Thanks so much, Chantal, as always, for the insights and for the time. That's Chantal Marks, Head of Research at F&B Wealth and Investments, on the market movements on US Election Day and what could potentially continue to drive markets going forward for the rest of the week.
The Property Pod.
The township and rural shopping centre subsector of the property market continues to thrive, with more development on the go as investors pile in. On the Property Pod this week, we speak to Smital Rambai, Portfolio Manager of the Unlisted Community Property Fund, or Comprop as it is better known. Comprop is invested in SA's township and rural retail property market.
The Property Pod.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Ratings agency Fitch has decided that they want to take a bit of a more positive view on South Africa. They're not certain how much more positive yet. They want us to still prove ourselves, I suppose. But they are saying that they're willing to revisit and relook at our credit outlook and potentially re-rate us at some point. We don't know when. But I'm joined on the line by senior economist at PwC, Kanti Pai, to take a look at this, see if we can make sense of it and see how we get to how we get out of junk status, rather. Good evening, Kanti. Thanks so much for taking the time. Lovely to chat to you. This is the first time in a very long time we have some sense of optimism coming out of the ratings agencies. We eventually got to a point where we weren't just falling down the ladder, or at least just continually being downgraded, and we got to a point where we were as low as we could get, but somewhat stable. Now we might be climbing back up the ladder.
Good afternoon, Jimmy. Yeah, I think it's a positive thing because I guess it follows the reasons why we were downgraded to begin with, I guess, which has been our problematic debt levels. And then, of course, also the structural issues, as we like to call them, that have kept our growth low and forced us to borrow as we have. And it seems now that they are all the setup is there that suggests that, you know, all of the plans for the government are there. But of course, these are also still quite positive. I guess it may be overly optimistic at this time.
Yeah, how do we not get ahead of ourselves? Because we know in the past we've been told, look, there's a lot that needs to be done. There's a lot of kind of missing pieces that still need to be addressed. From where we are at the moment, the sentiment is looking better, but what do we actually need to do to be removed? What are those structural issues we need to attend to?
Well, clearly there's been some positive momentum, especially in terms of the reforms, as they have been led by the presidents and the treasury, especially thinking about network industries, skills, making sure that we're attracting the right kinds of skills, making sure the logistics, energy, all of these things are coming up together, and there seems to be that momentum has built, at least in terms of, I think, putting these reforms on paper and making sure that you are starting to see a lot of this engagement. The second part I thought that has been interesting, and I suspect is going to be very helpful at the time when we are still struggling to have our own money, because I think one of the things we were concerned about right at the beginning of the year when the government came out and said that we're going to actually, you know, be able to reduce debt because we reduce the deficit through our growth. We thought that the growth outlook that they put at the beginning of the year was a little bit high, and that has been the case. And that actually you need really these reforms to actually take root in a manner that makes sense. But one of the positive things is probably this idea of the public-private partnerships, where the government is really moving quite a pace to make sure that it can actually attract private capital into public projects in a manner that actually works in an environment where there isn't enough money in the public sector to be able to achieve these things. And perhaps one of the key things that's important there is that also, and one of the things we've been doing at PwC is also doing what we call public-private collaboration. And that sort of helps also in the governance and the management of the infrastructure in a manner that you haven't had before if you just have one party. And that has, as a country, those two things working together are probably quite positive, because you're able to say, look, let's all co-invest in the infrastructure that we need in terms of the structure of the economy, but also let's make sure that we are all working towards the same in terms of governance. And that's something that has been lacking for quite some time. That's quite important.
Kanti, I want to look at some of the sentiments as well. Obviously, this re-rating from Fitch's perspective, they alluded to the fact that it came off of some of the sentiments that came out of the midterm budget policy statement as well. And that was such an important thing to be able to use that kind of opportunity or that kind of time for reassuring the international community that we are getting things back on track and we're seriously getting things back on track. Do we think that we could have said a bit more in the MTBPS that might have improved just perhaps even how other ratings agencies see us?
Well, I think everybody is starting to think about it in the same manner, and we'll probably hear from the other ratings agencies sort of sharing the same compliment, because I think one of the things that Fitch says, and all of them will probably look at it because they look at it over a period of time, right? So we have, you know, the medium term. And although they say, look, In the medium term, there's probably a little bit of optimism from this part of government in terms of growth and in terms of actually how they hold down that debt. So that is something that they will be looking at quite closely. But certainly, as they think about the restructuring, for example, of the different institutions of government that actually are supposed to support growth, so the logistics businesses, the thing about energy and all of that, that they see that as something that's going to need further investment, and so that's likely not to get us to the debt levels that they are talking about. But at the same time, that if you look at in the longer term outlook, because remember, when they talk about the outlook, when they say the outlook is positive, they're not necessarily, and I think you noted this right at the beginning, that they're not necessarily improving the rating itself. They're actually looking at the outlook, so a positive outlook towards the improvement of a rating. And that's something that you want to start with, so that you say, look, we actually are looking at the outlook and we think the outlook is positive. It's not just stable as I've kept it, but to say, look, there's a positive outlook. And if we keep up that positive outlook, that allows us to actually improve the rating as we see things improve drastically. But so it's not something that we think we can see in the next year or so, but it's probably something that we see in the 3-year cycle.
Yeah, no, we're definitely still not out of the woods, because Fitch has affirmed that we are still three levels below investment grade. We're stable in terms of outlook, we're positive in terms of outlook, but we are definitely not yet back at investment grade. How do we get back to investment grade?
Well, we have to make sure that actually the risk that we've seen in terms of our debt and our ability to repay that debt, remember our debt repayments are quite high, and that because the main thing really is investment grade is an indication of whether the ability to pay the debt is something that everybody can live with. And so in this sense, when they say you are sub-investment grade, they're looking at your debt levels and your borrowing, and they're saying, look, we're worried about your ability in some future stage to be able to pay. So basically, it's a warning of your ability to pay as time goes by. And so that is something that we have to improve. And already we are saying, for example, at the moment that we are paying 20 cents to every rand of revenue. And that's something of serious concern in order to be able, you know, if you think about your ability to pay over a longer term period. So if that picture improves, then that actually also improves our ability then to pay. So if we maybe move back a little bit and hold back, that's actually going to be helpful. So our ability to pay is something that we have to improve over a period of time. It's not something a threat at the moment, but it is something that if we had to see further deterioration would actually help. So we need to improve that substantially for everybody to say, okay, cool, now we are comfortable that you're at a place where, you know, your revenue is keeping pace with your ability, with your debt levels, in a manner that we can say, look, you are actually, you know, we can say you are sort of a safe haven, as it were.
We need to improve our credit score as a country. Otherwise, we're not going to get more credit. That's the crux of it. And that's where we're going to leave the conversation. Lovely to speak to you as always, Kanti. Thanks so much for the time and insights. Kanti Pai, senior economist at PwC, on Fitch considering the credit outlook of South Africa, seeing us as more positive than we were in the past. But we're not out of the woods yet.
There's an eerie feeling of calm before the storm in the crypto market. This is among the longest periods where Bitcoin has remained range bound for so long. My name is Shivan Mudli. I'm the macro strategist at 88, and I will be on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, where I'll give my prediction on what is likely to happen next in the crypto market.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
For those that tuned into the show yesterday, you would have remembered we spoke to the Business for South Africa Steering Committee Chair around just the commitments made by South African businesses to collaborate more with government and build private-public partnerships more and more. We've also seen in recent times an increased attention being paid, or at least increased focus being placed on acquisitions people have been buying up certain businesses, people have been selling off certain businesses. And I thought we'd take a look at that space, look at what's been happening on the mergers and acquisitions side in terms of some of the deals that have gone through, and if we can find a pattern. I'm joined on the line by Andrew Bauman, director at Deal Leaders International, to take a look at this. He keeps a close eye on all of the deals that are taking place in South Africa and around the world. Good evening, Andrew. Lovely to speak to you again. It seems as though now's the right time if you have capital to be looking for things to buy.
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks again for having me. Yeah, absolutely. I think there's definitely an appetite for acquisitions. Post-GNU, you know, from an international perspective, looking at South Africa, you know, there's been a definite uptick as well. So, yeah, there's a lot of hunters out there looking for, you know, good value acquisitions. And no longer discounted valuations, which is also good to see. But I guess the art is in finding the right buyer, and more importantly, finding the right target and getting the deal across the line.
And for some companies, Andrew, it's freeing up some of your non-core assets, looking at your business and saying, you know what, we don't actually think we're going to be able to continue making money off of this particular asset, so rather sell it off and buy something else we're interested in, because we're also seeing some of that. We're seeing some non-core disposals, some freeing up of cash. It doesn't really matter where you look. I mean, I'm thinking about South African companies in particular, but if you look at someone like Warren Buffett, who's offloading massive amounts of Apple shares and is sitting on probably the biggest cash pile in history, you're clearly seeing that nobody's kind of willing to sit there and let this pass them by.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's quite interesting how it always works in cycles. So, you know, whatever the industry is and that period of its cycle, you'll see there's periods of consolidation or focusing on core assets, which, you know, you're so right in saying there's a definite trend, you know, going in from that perspective. And then the concentration risk gets a little bit higher, and then there's a diversification into you know, different exposures. But yeah, there definitely seems to be a focus to get more niche, you know, and I guess it comes down to from a company group or investment perspective, where are your best returns? So in some of those non-core assets, if they're not giving you the same returns as you're getting in other parts of your business, if it makes sense to, you know, to potentially offload that. And we have seen a couple of examples like that recently.
Andrew, you mentioned cycles, and I wanted to see if we could look at some of the deals. I mean, we don't have to get into some of the specifics of the deals, because obviously a lot of them might still be up in the air. But where it comes down to cycles from a company perspective, I also noted, just based on two or three deals, that it's also now down to cycles in terms of industries people want to be exposed to. So I'm looking at deals like the Vodacom Maziv deal that didn't go through, that was blocked by the Competition Commission, the Old Mutual AECI asphalt deal that was announced today, the Gaia Bakwena investment deal as well. The common thread I kind of picked up there is all three were infrastructure plays, and we've seen a very concerted effort from the public-private partnerships to be developing infrastructure, going into those sorts of areas. Is that kind of where things are from a South African point of view, at least? A lot of the focus is looking towards things that are going to grow the economy.
Yeah, look, it's a great perspective that you've identified there, Jimmy. I think there's a definite push into, you know, those three examples you mentioned, into growing and building, you know, infrastructure, because clearly at a, you know, at a country level, it's really, really required. So that's a definite target. I think, yeah, the example of Vodacom and Maziv, I think there's, outside of the Competition Commission challenges, there's a real need for, you know, for significant investment in our telco infrastructure to, you know, to get it up to speed. And yeah, you know, I think there's other examples, you know, potentially with the BHP and Anglo, you know, mining services is also, you know, a big part of it. Again, I guess because of the commodity cycles as well as what it does for investment in the economy. But it's good to see the public-private partnership playing out, you know, with some proper deployment of capital and, you know, this growing demand to get behind, you know, what's required to hopefully restore our road infrastructure and definitely our rail and port infrastructure. So I'm really hoping to see that this is the beginning of an upcycle for the foreseeable future.
Andrew, something else I noticed and picked up on around some of these deals is companies are kind of looking more at I'd rather buy, and to your point on the BHP Anglo deal, is rather than going out and investing in greenfield projects, starting a project from scratch, building everything up, I'd rather just buy something that's running. It's got existing cash flows. Yeah. It's got financial statements. I know the stability of the business. And if I have to tweak a couple of things and make improvements, that's seemingly a better option than starting from scratch.
Yeah, look, definitely. You know, I think one, you know, whatever piece of strategy and growth work one does, there's obviously organic growth and acquisitions, and you know, a very, very prominent part of that strategy. You know, I think what often muddies the water is, like we saw with the Vodacom deal being blocked by the Competition Commission, and obviously the valuation. You know, so if you look at the BHP example, but yeah, you know, I think that's, you know, it's not only the acquisition of the target, it's also that diversification and growth runway that it unlocks. And yeah, I think gone are the days where, you know, there were almost hollow threats by acquirers to say, well, if I'm not going to buy this business, we'll go and do it ourselves. I just think it's, you know, the landscape's become a lot more difficult. And yeah, to your point, rather buy into momentum, buy into cash flows, and buy into, you know, basically, you know, an established business infrastructure network and channel to market. It just makes a lot more sense. And ironically, we'll probably end up, you know, costing the acquirer less than if they had to try and do it themselves.
Andrew, what's to be said about the different kinds of sectors? We're seeing an emergence of things like artificial intelligence, and that's obviously driving just how investors are seeing things. I'm looking in particular at the announcement that we got probably a couple of minutes before you and I went on air with this conversation, that Gaia Fund Managers are taking a stake in Bakwena Platinum Corridor Concession, the toll operator that operates the tolls between the N4 and the N1. Now, interestingly enough, when I looked at that, I mean, you don't typically see a fund manager going after a toll operator as an investment case, but you are seeing that regardless of the acquisitions, people are diversifying their portfolios in some cases where there might have been a concentration risk, things like the property space, you're concentrated in one kind of area, and now you're either diversifying across portfolio class or asset classes, or you're diversifying across regions. You're no longer looking in one country, you're looking in other countries.
Absolutely. Yeah, look, and it's quite an interesting, you know, example there, because you are right. It's not a, you know, I did see that, you know, that note come through, and it's not your typical, you know, M&A type transaction, particularly from a fund manager. And I think the key there is, you know, obviously I haven't seen a lot of detail around it, but, you know, part of Gaia's strategy is really around infrastructure, you know, so whether it's an infrastructure platform or, you know, current and new, whatever it is. But it is interesting that they've gone out of, to your, you know, description, probably more traditional investment sectors, and now going in, you know, in this direction. So it's a very interesting place, see how it'll play out. But again, you know, one has to then look at sentiment. You know, hopefully it's yet another positive sentiment and investment in this new trajectory that hopefully will help us get our infrastructure back to the standard it needs to be at.
Andrew, do you think some of the investment plays or the decisions being made are being made from having learned from the past? And I think, again, I'll use the fund managers as an example, because when we look back to kind of what happened in the pandemic and all fund managers and asset managers struggling for returns, recently the likes of the PIC saying the offshore business, the offshore investments are struggling from things like grey listing impacts. Do you think that fund managers now might, going forward, be making these sorts of decisions more and more to say traditional things that we knew and loved might not always be the way to go, and perhaps we might be looking at a new way of investing going forward?
I would think so. You know, one always hopes that all of us learn, you know, learn from past experiences. And I think what the last few years have taught us is nothing is a given. And, you know, what may have been stable investments, industry sectors, whatever that may be, have turned out to not necessarily be that again, you know. And so, yeah, I think there needs to be a degree of innovation, and it'll be interesting to see what other examples, you know, of this type of investment takes place. But I think like any industry, there's got to be evolution, there's got to be innovation. And I guess it also comes down to risk appetite. But, you know, if you look at how Gaia have done it, you know, one would think infrastructure on existing tolls is quite a solid investment. There's, you know, there's cash flows and whatever it is behind it. Maybe not a bad thing, but, you know, I think you've seen those returns on, you know, those fund managers that were overexposed to rates and, you know, all of those elements from a property perspective, and then the pain through COVID and thereafter, you know, probably did, you know, take a, you know, a bit of a beating and realized, well, let's start looking at where other people are deploying capital or where there's a really good growth runway. So it'll be interesting to play out how it plays out, you know, in the foreseeable future.
We have much to learn. The world is constantly changing, but the one thing we can be assured of is that there will always be opportunities if you can find them. We'll leave it at that, Andrew. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Andrew Ballman, Director at Deal Leaders International, on some of the mergers and acquisitions deals that have been taking place, as well as some potential trends we might have identified.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, at one point, South Africa was considered 32nd best in terms of the countries that were easy to do business with. There's an index that goes out that ranks countries based on ease of business, and we ranked 32nd at some point. Surprise, surprise, we no longer rank 32nd. We are down 84th, if that is still the up-to-date figure. I'll see if I can pull the up-to-date figure while we're on this chat. But for the purposes of this discussion, we went from 32nd to 84th, and we're going to try and find out how we get back up on that list. Joined on the line by Brian Silk, who's the associate partner at Hudson Sandler Invercom, to take a look at this and see how we can best prepare ourselves. Good evening, Brian. Thanks so much for taking the time. First of all, how did we go from 32nd to 84th?
Good evening, Jimmy. Thank you very much for having me on the show. Just quickly, I want to take a couple of steps back. So what informed this piece, if I go back a couple of weeks to a panel discussion, we hosted it Gibbs, there was government, private sector, and funders present. And a key message which came out there was around South Africa having an 18-month window approximately, one bite of the cherry in terms of securing foreign direct investment in what is a very competitive emerging markets landscape. And some of these issues came up there. I think the key thing is that messaging needs to be consistent in order to understand what it is we're asking of the international investment community. It needs to talk to the value of the proposition of South Africa. Just in terms of your question, you know, what possibly informed South Africa's decline on the World Bank's Ease of Doing Business Index? I think there are a number of things, many of which we know about, but I think key up high up in the list is probably bureaucratic inefficiencies. You know, South Africa is a complex regulatory environment, slow government processes, and that deters business operations. And then load shedding, as we know, of the last couple of years, persistent energy issues, and they've disrupted industry, increased operational costs, and then obviously infrastructure deterioration. There's been a lot of talk about that on the show and in general. And I think just one last thing is around policy uncertainty. You know, there have been frequent, both domestic and international, frequent policy shifts around lack of clarity around issues like land reform, which essentially creates an unstable business climate. And that's without going into issues around corruption, graft, and governance. So those are some of the issues which may have informed this decrease or this decline.
Brian, when we look at the position of South Africa, understanding that we know some of the issues, how do we move forward? What lessons do we need to learn and to apply? You touched on something around the fact that there's been a lot of red tape where it comes to decision-making and policy certainty. Right. How do we move forward so that going forward, we do have an easier environment for investors to say, hang on, we can go invest in South Africa?
So I think there are a number of opportunities, some quick wins. I think post the establishment of the Government of National Unity, we've seen in terms of streamlining bureaucracy and bureaucratic processes, especially for starting and running small businesses, SMEs. I think some of the initiatives from Home Affairs Minister Leon Schreiber have been commendable, as well as the collaboration at the DTIC between Minister Parkstown, Andrew Whitfield, one of the deputies. That kind of streamlining of the process is removing some of the barriers to entry. I mean, enabling easier track to attaining work visas, etc. That's one area. I think in terms of policy, ensuring policy stability, and this will come probably in the medium to long term, is, and again, this will come, you know, through better collaboration between government and the private sectors, establishing call them long-term policy frameworks, which investors can rely on. So they know that if they invest, you know, X amount into the economy in 2025, that they're doing it on the proviso that 3 years down the line, policy should be similar. I think in terms of strengthening infrastructure, and this came through, I think, quite strongly in my piece, especially with the announcement that Gauteng will be the host province, both the city of Johannesburg and Tshwane, for the 2025 G20 and B20 meetings, is prioritizing and upgrading critical infrastructure, which can support consistent business activity. The physical environment or the built environment has to be conducive for businesses to want to do business and invest in the province. And again, I'm referring to Gauteng, but that can be true of the whole of South Africa. I think in terms of another area about combating corruption and kind of increasing accountability, deploying the right resources into the police and ensuring that there's transparency within government institutions, I think the government has started to undertake the correct steps. A lot of this will come with time, but it seems like the right signals have been sent out to the investment community.
Brian, something a friend of mine said to me recently I found very interesting was he said he wishes that we would have more of these summits, the G20-like summits, and host more of these events, because seemingly when we host these things, infrastructure and other things are fixed rather quickly. How do we make sure that the solutions we put in place are not temporary for the sake of things like the G20 gatherings, and that it's actual sustainable solutions that we put in place on a permanent basis?
Right. So I think you're 100% right. And again, I'll cite Gauteng, but this is true for the whole country. It's building long-term sustainability and resilience to support the investor case. I think the first point needs to be about sustainable infrastructure. So prioritize green and resilient infrastructure projects to meet, call it, the future needs and not the present needs. I think in terms of urban planning and transport, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done there around urban mobility and accessibility. Transnet comes up over there in that discussion to make Gauteng a more attractive business hub. I think another area is around skills development, and this is also in the long term. So ensuring that our educational frameworks align with industry demands, particularly in sectors like technology and energy, green energy, etc. And then I think an important point is around economic diversification. You know, like we need to encourage investment beyond what have been the traditional, the legacy sectors that South Africa has been known for, such as mining and heavy industry, and move into areas such as tech, finance, and services. And that would likely ensure a more balanced economy going forward and a more investable economy.
Brian, when we look at that investable economy and we look at things going forward, what do you think the new or the role will be of this new BRICS bloc in repositioning South Africa, but also repositioning just global trade? It's very clear that the bloc is here to stay. It accounts for 30% of the world's trade activity based on member countries that are currently involved there. Do you think that there's value in exploring new partnerships like that for the purposes of repositioning South Africa for a better future?
So I think that's a great question, Jimmy. I think if we had to strip out, call it the ideological questions or concerns around the geopolitical alignment, I think purely from a building of South Africa perspective, you know, how does the BRICS bloc, you know, feature in repositioning trade for South Africa? I think market access is critical. So opening up wider trade networks, especially across emerging economies. I think also in terms of investment opportunities, South Africa can attract funding for sectors like energy and manufacturing from some of these partner countries. And then I think in terms of enhanced bargaining power, this is very important, increased, you could call it collective influence in negotiations on trade terms and investment policies globally. And then perhaps the last thing might be about, call it a transfer of knowledge or skills or knowledge exchange. So I think better collaboration with countries in the BRICS bloc can kind of drive innovation, which, you know, may be lacking in South Africa. And so too, from our perspective, we can impart skills to our fellow BRICS bloc countries.
If ever there was a time to look at improving things, now is that time, because we've seen it before in the past. We've seen it in the likes of countries like Singapore. It is very possible to turn things around. We don't have to stay 84th on this World Bank list. We can get back higher up on the list, but we have to do it, and we have to do it together. We'll leave it at that, Brian. Thanks so much for the insights and for the time. Brian Silk, who is the associate partner at Hudson Sandler Invercom, joining us to take a look at the investment case that exists for South Africa, for Gauteng, and for the African continent, I suppose, to a certain extent.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Agri Tuesday. It is not the turn of Property Tuesday. And this week, we are taking a look at the agricultural space and the demand that we might be seeing come through from that space in the weeks and months to come. There's certainly a sense of optimism around the state of the fruit and export markets that we know and love in South Africa. And we're taking a look at just how the fruit industry could be poised to have a really good 2025. I'm joined on the line by the procurement manager at True Cape, Carla Du Toit, to take a look at this and try and make sense of it. Good evening, Carla. Thanks so much for taking the time. You seem to be exceptionally bullish on the fruit industry at the moment. What has you so excited?
Jimmy, there's so many things that's really turning South Africa's way. We just come off a very, very good 2024 season. And I think the fact that we could open up as an industry, we could open up a whole range of new markets. It was our highest volume ever into markets like India. In Vietnam, we were very strong. China is growing. So there's just so many new opportunities for us.
Carla, I want to look at the state of the agri space in South Africa. Obviously, agriculture is such a big contributor towards things like GDP and job creation and towards the communities that the fruit industry, for example, services. But just take me through just how much more value this space can add towards everything that is around it and everything that is in the country.
Well, I think... I know that agriculture is one of the industries that have a massive potential for job creation. You know, in this country, we really need two things. We need economic growth and we need employment. And agriculture have that ability. So it's always good to see growth in the agricultural sector, because we know that it comes with economic development. And normally in an area where there's good agriculture activity, there's good infrastructure, there's good roads, there's industries, secondary industries that work with the product. So agricultural development for any area is always coming with a lot of other positives as well. Job creation, infrastructure creation, and I would say stability regarding employment, because we need more and more people to harvest, we need more and more people to pack. And the fruit industry is an example of that. There's definitely massive scope for growth. And as an industry, we would like to be part of the solutions of this country and create opportunities for growth and employment.
Carla, when we look at those growth opportunities going into, say, 2025 and beyond, what do those kind of opportunities look like? Are we seeing some other offshore markets showing an increase in demand for our fruits? I mean, I know that we export quite a bit of our citrus into the likes of Europe, but are we seeing just in general that the world is saying we want more of South African fruits?
No, definitely. Since COVID, since 2020, there have been some major shifts in shipping costs and shipping routes, and I would say the whole global situation have changed for fresh fruit exports. And fortunately for us, South Africa have been one of the winners. We are very close to Europe, as you know. By ship, it's between 14 and I would say 21 days, depending on where the ship stops and depending on a specific route. But it's quite close by, so it's easy for Europe to do business with us. But the Far East and the Middle East have also become very important for us. You know, a few years ago, Chile was the biggest exporter of fresh fruit to those markets, but their shipping situation have changed drastically. Their costs have gone up and they cannot use the same routes because of global political aspects. So it played into our hand. But I think what also have helped us is the development of new varieties. And South Africa is known for a very good eating quality. We as you know, we have a lot of sunshine, and normally our fruit eats very, very well. It's preferred by more and more people across the globe. New Zealand have also been a very good exporter of good quality and big volumes, but the distance from the market is really becoming a problem for them. And the availability of labor is also a big issue in a country like New Zealand. So there's a lot of other around us that plays into our hand and actually help us to become more and more competitive. And that's very good news to South African agriculture in general.
Carla, how do these smaller guys in the space benefit? I mean, South Africa's got such a vast agricultural playing field, and there are much bigger producers like TrueCape, but there's also a lot smaller farmers and growers around. How do we leverage off of this unique demand and this interest that's currently being shown towards South African fruits, and how do we benefit the smaller players and the smaller industries?
Well, even within the bigger TrueCape family, we got a lot of smaller growers. I think the secret here is to work together as one team. And sometimes you have one small grower with one specific variety, and we just put that together with other growers and to offer our customers a wider range of varieties and fruit types. So for us, TrueCape is quite a big business today, and it has grown significantly over the past few years. But I think the reason for that is good teamwork, and there's definitely a sense of unity and working together. So for us as a business, it doesn't really depend if a grower is big or small. We need them all, and they complement one another. And some of our smaller growers, they are specialists in a specific field or specialists in a specific variety. And they bring a lot to the table in the sense that they form part of a bigger offer to our global customers. So we are very excited about new growers, a new entrance into our industry. And some of them are very small. They start on a very small basis, but they definitely contribute a lot, and they bring a lot of value to the broader industry.
What about the other challenges that the industry has faced over the last couple of years and months? I think about logistics challenges as an example. We know for a fact that not all growers and not all producers are near ports and able to get their produce towards ports. And so you rely on a very, very strong logistics channel and infrastructure system to be able to get things to where they need to go. How are we seeing that shape up? Are we seeing a better logistical infrastructure set up from the likes of Transnet and other logistics providers?
Jimmy, there is improvement, definitely. I think there's new energy, there's new people involved. We've been through a very, very tough time. I mean, 2022, 2023 seasons were really massive. They were massive challenges. Some ships were waiting so long in some of our ports that they, in the end, they decided to simply just to leave. And I think most of us know the ratings of port performance across the globe, and it's still not looking good for South Africa. So yeah, we needed new energy, and I think that's there. There's new people that's been appointed who have a fresh approach. But it takes time, you know, it takes time to get that mindset right. And we actually need a mindset of that infrastructure development is good for everyone in the economy, not only the growers, it's good for everyone. If there's growth and new opportunities, everyone will benefit. So, yeah, we've been through a tough time. But I think also, obviously, load shedding made our lives very hard for quite a long time. But South Africans in general have always, they have this tendency to make new plans and to find a way. And I think that have been the motto of our fruit industry. We just had to find new ways. And we even trucked fruit up to places like Walvis Bay, Namibia, and even to Maputo, just to make sure that we can load the ships. That's obviously not ideal, because it comes along with a lot of added cost, and we don't want that. So in short, there's a new energy to rectify these problems. But if you have growth into your infrastructure, you must look after your roads, you must look after your ports, and you must make sure they're highly capable and efficient. And unfortunately, that wasn't the case when the real opportunities opened up for us in towards 22 and 23, we were simply not ready, and our ports were not ready. But I want to give credit to everyone who's working. There's a lot of industry people. There's a lot of Transnet people who's working around the clock to make sure that there's improvement. And as a grower and as an export company, we can see there's improvement. But we have to accept that it will take some time to really get to the point where we want to be. But it must be a, once again, it must be a team effort. Everyone must work towards finding new ways of making everything just more efficient. But you cannot be effective in exports if you don't have ports that function properly and are highly effective. It just cannot work.
The power of collaboration has never been more important than it is now if we are to get these industries back online and to see the most benefit that we can for South Africa. Thank you so much, Kala, for those insights. We'll leave it at that. That's Kala Dutoy, who is the procurement manager at True Cape, on the state of the fruit industry in South Africa and how it ranks up against some of the other industries around the world. It's just gone 7 o'clock. Greg Coase is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.